I'm using a new system today for recording, so it's kind of homebrew. Okay, so it's time to start. Homework. First week of homework. First, I want to show hands. See who started it. Okay. There are a few who thinks you have finished it. You know, you got a good handle on it. About four-ish. Okay. So, that's what we're here for. You know, you have 1.5 days left or so until the deadline. So, if you have any issues, we need to iron them out now. So, go ahead and tell me.
I got a general question. For the assignment we set the sandwich date and set the other stuff, is it customary for people to use the git function to test it and then change it? Rather than, because it seems to me that changing those often will be very cost inefficient.
Okay, that's state management. So what I was suggesting that you do for state management in the homework, and I kind of laid it out a little bit that way, you know, is to be aggressive with state setting. So the idea is, you know what you're going to render. You're an expert in D3E someday, maybe, right? So you know, okay, so I'm going to render this. I'm going to use the states. And, you know, there are other states that do not play any part in this particular, you know, thing that I'm rendering. So, and then you go ahead and set all those states. Don't leave anyone. Don't leave any single piece of state that might actually affect the way your thing is drawing. That's, in some ways, one of the easiest to handle situations. D3D under the hood is going to do something like that. You know, you call into D3D to set the state. It says, oh, it's the same. Whatever. I don't need to change anything. Because this really keeps a copy of all the state. You can always retrieve it with a get render state or get sampler state or whatever it is. Okay. So again, you know, you have strategies. One of them is to save one of them that many people do is to assume certain states, and then whatever you're going to modify in your function, you save all that state first, you change whatever you need, and then you reset it backwards, you know, to what it's supposed to be. That is costly, but I keep seeing over and over many people doing it all over. I'd prefer to start, you know, encouraging better ways of doing things. And one of them is that whenever you're going to say draw primitive, draw index primitive, or whatever, one of those functions that we need to actually perform the draw, you know, just before that, set every single last piece of state that affects that draw. If you leave any of those states, what happens is, you know, you are working your game, right? And suddenly you add a function to render lens flares, for instance. And suddenly your models disappear when you render the lens flares. You comment out the lens flares and your models appear fine. And you're, you know, you start pulling your hair and say, what the heck is going on here? You know, and what you have is bleeding of state from one part of the game to another. If you make sure that you set everything that affects your draw, then you're not gonna, you know, that particular function is not gonna be affected by the rest of the game. So yeah, I do suggest that you set every single last piece of state. You know, texture states, sampler states, render states, everything. And yeah, there are, you know, when people are making a game and they start caring about performance a lot, they might do things like keep their own version of state in batches. Like, what is my blend mode right now? And you have maybe 10 different blend modes. So it's just like an enumeration, right? And, you know, you make your own function that says, oh, set alpha blending, set additive blending, set pre-multiplied alpha blending, things like that. Okay, those are different blend modes. They affect all those little blend registers. If you do it through your own little enum of the ones that you use, then you can, you know, you can just compare that and not set all those different pieces of state. And it's an optimization. That's all it is. It's an optimization. And, you know, they recognize that, and in D3.10, they change the way state is handled. They use state blocks, you know, pre-built state blocks. So, but that doesn't help you here. D3.9 does have an API to set a state block. You know, there's a resource, which is a state block, and you can say, oh, set all your states. You can use that if you want. It is less efficient than actually setting the states. because it's data-driven, and it's, you know, the most naive implementation that you could possibly think of for that, that you could do yourself. You know, that's basically what happens under the hood, pretty much. Make sense? Answer your question?
I just, when I was running in full debug mode, I get worried. Setting, ignoring redundancy, set same thing.
Yeah, I mean, if one function sets alpha blending in the blend unit, you know, the blend states, and then another function also sets the same states again, then that's redundant states. That makes D3D work more. You could try to optimize by saying, hey, you know, I know that I'm calling function A first and function B next, so I'm going to remove the setting of alpha blending in function B. You know, but then if you insert that function C in between the two, and it sets, I don't know, additive blending, then suddenly functions B stops working. So it makes your code fragile.
Well, all I was doing is checking the state, and then
well, yeah, but D3 does that under the hood. Yeah. What you're doing is saying, oh, I don't want these warnings. But in some ways, you know, warnings are good. You know, but sometimes they're just ignorable, like this, right? Right, if you make a conscious decision. So, but anyway, so any other questions about the homework specifically?
What time of the day is it doing?
It's due on Saturday morning. 10 a.m. Yeah, because somebody was asking questions before starting the class.
So it's valid.
I could repeat what I said then, you know, but if you have a specific question, that might be better.
Trigonometry?
Yeah. You can use trigonometry, you can use matrices, you can use, you know, there are various ways of doing it, you know, to handle the rotation function. In my own implementation, I use straight trigonometry, just because, I don't know, that's easier for me. But, yeah. Yes?
I did find that my circle rotates the opposite direction that you rotate. Is that a problem?
No, it's not a problem. I actually did not define which way it should rotate, so. And, do you use trigonometry or matrices or matrices? You create your matrix yourself, or do you use like, you know, raw pitch yaw type?
No.
Or rotate around axis or
I don't remember exactly.
You don't remember how you create your matrix? Okay. Oh, okay. So, yeah, I mean, you can, you know, there are the 3DX functions, and, you know, we'll talk a little bit about the 3DX, but, you know, there are functions in there to create matrices based on parameters. There's one which is, you know, matrix that rotates around, by some angle around some axis. They're all for 3D, but you can always say, oh, I set all the Z's to zero, just half X, Y. And you can use that. Do you see? Yes?
You mentioned in 3DX, you didn't specify in the homework that you can't use D, yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. I didn't say that you could, but I didn't say that you couldn't, and I did add, you know, include the 3DX9.h at the top of the homework file, so, which wasn't needed there, but. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course.
So you use just the rotation matrix and then the translation. That's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
Translated it to the center, rotated it, translated it back.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, if you realize that rotation is actually a change, you know, conceptually you need to do a change of frame of reference there. Because you are rotating around something that's not 0, 0. You know, if you do, you know, you have your screen and, you know, your sprite rotates around that top left corner, it's not right, you know, that's the naive way. You just need to change the frame of reference so that the rotation is around the center of the rectangle. And then you rotate and then change it back, you know, inverse, you know, frame of reference transfer.
I was
going to
say translation origin, rotate it, translate
that. Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, there are always many ways of visualizing any of these things. Mm. But the change of frame of reference is the most, I don't know how to say it. Mm-hmm. It's the most formal one, I would say. So
for the multi math, sort of trying to figure out,
mm-hmm. the mini map.
You create a texture programmatically.
Mm-hmm. You can create it programmatically. You can paint it yourself if you want. I don't care. You know, I just want you to get, you know, actually use the stuff of doing simple 2D primitives, you know, and you know, actually use it in your game, you know, for the star credit.
Because you mentioned that there's two ways to do it. There's like the sprite way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, just imagine, you have a map. So, let me actually... So... Say this is your screen, okay, and this is your texture. Okay, your texture contains a picture of the map, you know, you have there are obstacles, whatever, you know, you paint them. It should resemble the actual map that you have. Otherwise, it's kind of silly. but you have that texture. So the idea is you're going to, I don't know, here or whatever, you're going to do a mini map. Okay? The idea is that at any point in time, you are in some location in this map, say this is your position within the world, and say that you're looking in that direction, right? Okay? So what you need is to render this so that this is your location, and that's the way you're walking. Mm-hmm. So it would look something like this. Probably. So you need to find the coordinates. This one's right. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one way. There are many ways, but that's one way. You know, find the screen coordinates that actually makes it so this is where you are, right? And again, that's kind of like a change of frame of reference. Okay.
You can just populate a bitmap.
Yeah. use paint.map. It's free and easy.
Oh, no, but I mean,
that's what I did.
I mean, this is good. The mini map changes as you move around.
Yeah.
So.
But the thing is, the mini map itself, this thing, what you see here, changes. Okay, but what you use in order to render that doesn't. I mean, your world, you know, your grid in the game is not changing, right? It's always the same one. You know, so you have a texture that represents that. Yeah, you are moving around a maze, but the thing is, you represent the entire maze in a texture. The whole thing. The whole thing. Right? It's an asset. It's part of what makes your world what it is.
Although, you could add dynamic elements to, like, where the NPC is.
Yeah. That's why, you know, you can complicate and complicate it, you know, as much as you want. And, it actually adds, you know, a very interesting element to the game, you know, to have that. You know, because the game, you know, is kind of like a maze. Although, you know, it might not be a real maze, you know, like hard to navigate, but yeah, I mean, you have your level.grd file, you know, represent that in a texture. And then use that texture smartly in your game so that you would render the texture like that maybe, but then you cut it out. So that the only thing you see is that part of the texture, you know, what would go in here. And you can cut it out with geometry and generating texture coordinates. You know, you can cut it out by having a texture, right, with trunk, you know, with alpha set to, say, 1 inside of the circle and 0 outside of the circle. Things like that. And then, of course, you would have to use the texture stages or a pixel shader if you actually know how to do that already. In order to mix the two textures appropriately. Any other questions? Okay. So, I would say get cranking and finish that homework. And please don't be late. No. I always forget which one it is. Actually better. So, last week we saw a little bit about D3D states, and we've talked a little bit about state management and, you know, what happens when you don't do it right, because, you know, some things don't work, and you don't know why, because they're affected by something else in the game. But, you know, D3D is kind of vast. As an API, I mean, it's not super huge, but it has a very non-trivial surface. So, you know, I just thought, you know, we'd go through it a little bit. So make sure that you're all aware of what things are there. I'm not going to explain you in detail how to use any single one of them. That's best done. If you ever need, you know, one of those, you know, you can go ahead and fire email to the list and I'll answer it, or somebody else will. If you have any questions. So this is just, you know, the very basic stuff. So one idea about Direct3D is that it's an abstraction. It's an abstraction over that piece of hardware, your graphics card, your GPU. It's supposed to represent a sort of virtual GPU that's been standardized. The idea is that then NVIDIA does a GPU and it actually maps into Direct3D, and ATI or AMD, like they're called now, makes a GPU and also, you know, it's mapped into Direct3D. Okay. In Direct3D 9, the way different underlying implementations differentiate from each other is through capabilities. So Direct3D 9 has this very big structure that you can query from your device, which is D3D caps. And this is a whole series of bits and numbers and quantities related to what the graphics chip can do. Things like how big can my textures be? Things like how many textures can I have? Things like can my textures be arbitrary sizes, or do they have to be powers of two in dimensions? Okay. There are a lot of them. It's a mess to try to actually make your program so it adapts to any combination of capabilities. In the end, you know, the system actually kind of can't sustain its own weight. So in D3D 10, they switch to something else, which is called profiles. You can read about profiles in the D3D documentation, because they also apply to D3D 9 in some ways. So what they made is there is a D3D 10 profile, there's a D3D 10.1 profile, and what those profiles say is, oh, you know, this set of capabilities are guaranteed. You don't have to check for them at all. You have D3D 11 profile. And also, they have three profiles for D3D 9. They call it 9.1, 9.2, and 9.3. You can't check for those directly. But the 9.1 profile is actually pretty much guaranteed on any D3D 9 hardware out there. So you can always assume that those work. So, I mean, there's, again, in the documentation, there's information about what all those profiles mean. OpenGL had it right the first time in that it said, hey, you know, all hardware, all implementations have to conform to these capabilities. And they did not provide actually actual configuration of the underlying hardware. At the beginning, many graphics chips did not conform to everything, so OpenGL just said, oh, if the chip can't do it, then it'll have to be done in software, and it'll just be very slow, because they did not specify performance at all in any of in the definition of what the actual capabilities were. So, you know, that was kind of annoying, because you write your game and it runs fast, and then you run it in somebody else's and it runs slow because it hit one of the slow paths that actually go into software or some sort of emulation. Also, they realized that not all graphics chips are equal, so they put in OpenGL a mechanism to query for specific extensions to the API. So NVIDIA would put a set of extensions and document them, so you can go and query for them, and ATI would do the same thing, and so on. Again, it's just a different style. In the end, you always assume a lot of things. You will see, if you look in the Bejeweled game, you will see that just after creating the device, they go and start querying for supported texture formats. That's quite redundant, because all graphics chips support pretty much the same ones. There's actually no need to do that. You know, I just figured, you know, it would show that sort of thing in there and how it's done. If you look in the software renderer for today's, for this week's homework, you will see that it does it again. And in that case, it's actually quite needed because not absolutely all graphics cards support the same things. So one of the things I added there, in order to show you later, about gamma correction, you know, is I made that program gamma correct. Mm. And you can turn that on and off. Mm. And the thing is, in different cards, you have to do it differently. Mm. So in that case, you know, checking for configurability and exactly what the underlying hardware can do and how was actually necessary. Mm. There is a, regarding OpenGL, there's a variant which is called OpenGL ES, which is what you have in iPhones and, mobile, you know, Androids and things like that. Okay. In DirectX 3D, you're going to be handling lots of COM interfaces because that's what it's built upon. It does not use all the complexities of COM. Mm. In fact, many of you, or most of you, or maybe all of you, do not know what all the complexities of COM means. I'm not sure I do either.
How can you ever know them all?
what they did is sort of use the infrastructure provided by the COM, you know, the component model of Microsoft, to just build the API on it. Mm. In the end, what you have is objects, which you get a pointer to them, and their ownership and lifetime is matched through reference counting, which is a very common method in C++. Mm. Reference counting is something that requires responsibility. Mm. If you don't do it right, then you can leak objects, which is bad. Or even worse, you know, you could like use an object after it doesn't exist and that sort of thing. Mm. So just be careful. There's this little utility, the CCOM pointer, which is part of the COM libraries, and you know, it just helps you manage that. It's basically a smart pointer. Okay. So if you're comfortable using it, then it actually makes things easier. Mm. And this is just a list of the various interfaces, the various object types that you can get in Direct3D. The device, we all know it. It's what you use for changing state, among other things, and rendering. And it basically represents the GPU. So, you know, when you want to tell the GPU to do something, then, you know, that's what you use. You have the swap chain, which represents the screen. And they call it a swap chain because when one screen is visible, you want to be rendering into a different one, right? So there has to be at least two. There is resources, which has many different types of child objects. You know, there's a whole hierarchy under that. You know, there's textures and vertex buffers and index buffers and state blocks and things and all those. It basically represents data of some kind. Data that you've generated at runtime, or that you've loaded from disk, or then you have shaders, which we will use a lot during this course. Mm-hmm. Not quite yet, but we're almost there. We have vertex shaders and pixel shaders. You know, we'll see a little bit later what that means. But they're basically programs that you can compile from something kind of similar to C++, which actually run in the GPU. You have queries, which is when you need data extracted from the graphics chip. Like, oh, I rendered this model. Did it actually render any pixels? That's a query that you can do. And you will get that result back. The thing is, just be aware that the GPU runs some time behind the CPU. So when you say draw primitive UP, that doesn't mean the draw happens immediately. It'll actually happen maybe 100 milliseconds later. So usually you don't care, you know, that's an implementation detail of how D3D and the GPUs work. But when you use queries, you actually have to be aware of that, because it's going to take maybe several frames until you get the results from a query. State blocks, which is, you know, one of those types of resources. And it's one way to put state together. If it doesn't actually make things faster, you know, at least it might make them cleaner. You could set up a state block with every single piece of state. You know, just go to the documentation, you know, render state, T3D render state, copy every single last one of them and set them to some value, right? And put that in one of those state blocks. Then you can just reset the GPU to that, to all those states with just one call. So it can become convenient. Any questions about this? Yes.
Yeah, I've seen that there are some interfaces that have the same name without the version number. What about those?
What do you mean the same name without the version number? Like iDirect3D device? Those are all interfaces.
Yeah, but they are the same interface. They are alias.
Okay, I might actually be guessing too much in here, because I'm not exactly sure what you mean by this. But I'm pretty sure this is a sort of backwards compatibility thing. Way back in like the 3D 5, it was not iDirect3D device 5, it was iDirect3D device. When they moved to 6, I believe, they actually said, hey, you know, this is silly, you know. So they added the number so that you could have multiple versions of D3D coexisting. You know, at one point I made a game that, you know, well, I was working on an engine for a game that worked on Direct3D 6, 7, and 8 indistinctly, which is kind of interesting. And even today, you know, you can mix a little bit things from 9 and 10 and 11, you know, if you're in Vista or 7. Windows 7. But yeah, I mean, you know, the numbers is because this is the version of D3D that you're using, so, and they are different. They're not fully compatible with each other. So. Okay. Any other questions? I mean, this is just plumbing, right? But, you know, I kind of want to get it out of the way. Again, Direct3D has a lot of surface, and please do not be shy asking questions at any time, you know, during class or over email. So, Direct3DX is a bit of a mixed blessing. And if you ever play with D3D 11, you know, there's a Direct3DX 11, but it's very minimal compared to what is there in 9. Basically, this is just a utility library. Okay, that's one way to see it. It could be perfectly, you know, shipped separately from Direct3D. It's like you say, hey, you know, there are things that I do in Direct3D often, so I'm going to put them functions and classes and so on in a library and pack it up so that all my programs can use it and be more productive. The main problem that I have with Direct3D X is that it has some things that are quite necessary and you can't get anywhere else. And it has other things that you shouldn't use, to put bluntly. So, you know, I'll try to point out, you know, as we go through the different parts of it. Probably the most useful part of it is the math library, so, and you will all be using that. So it has a lot of functions to deal with 2D, 3D, and 4D vectors. Remember the four-dimensional vectors with the one at the end? With matrix math and all sorts of other esoteric math topics, okay? You know, it has a library for spherical harmonics, if you ever care about it. You know, it's got... it's actually pretty complete. D3DX also has ID3DX mesh. And that's something that you've already been using. Tiny is one of them, one of those meshes. There's things that you usually load from .x files, and it's a piece of geometry. That's supposed to be easy to use, and so on and so forth. This is one of the things that if I'm making a game, like, where my performance matters and my game is not going to be a very silly thing, then I wouldn't use it normally. Okay. And I wouldn't use it because, you know, it's not, it's just not the best way for, you know, performance and scalability. It's just nice and simple and easy, especially for samples. You know, a lot of parts of the D3X library are there just because some sample required some function and they put it there. You have the shader compiler and assembler. And that's a very important piece of functionality. Again, I wouldn't recommend compiling your shaders at runtime, but there are games that do it even today. Basically, they take the source code of this of the shader and they pass it through a compiler, and it generates, you know, while you're playing the game. Okay, that can be very slow. I mean, it can take even half a second if your shader is complex. But if you're doing tools to generate all the data for your game, you know, that's invaluable to have there. You have functions for text rendering, which is very useful. Again, it's not how we do text in a game, but it's good for simple stuff. You have animation library, and you have a whole bunch of other helper functions. And none of those have anything to do with the GPU or with the D3D. They don't require you to have a D3D device or anything like that. It's just code. Okay, let's see. That's packed in there. So there's one issue with Direct3DX which some people encounter as they're like, you know, developing a game. You know, they start relying on it And suddenly they say, hey, you know, but what about the PlayStation 3 version of the game? You know, what about the Wii version of the game? What about the Android version of the game? You know, even. And the thing is, you know, there are lots of useful functions in there, but you don't have it in those other platforms. It's just not there. So it kind of ties you to Microsoft and Windows. Or Xbox. You know, there's an implementation of it for Xbox. So it's just something that you need to just be aware of. You know, if you ever suspect that you might need to port a game to another platform, then you have to be careful what you depend on. Always. And D3DX is one of those things that easily sneaks through and bites you in the ass afterwards. Yeah. There are many game developers still doing their own custom engines for the game. Yeah, there are many. There used to be more. Nowadays, using something like Unreal Engine, you know, it has become quite easy. So lots of developers do that. But I wouldn't claim most. So, and many developers develop all sorts of utilities, you know, from texture coordinate generation, mesh optimization or conversion, or things like those. In many ways, you know, when you buy one of those engines, you have to buy into their mindset, right? Hey, you know, when you buy into Direct3D, you have to buy into the Direct3D mindset. You're like, but I don't want to use reference counting to manage my objects. You're like, what are you talking about, right? That's not right. So, and the thing is, you know, with something like D3D, you know, it's kind of low level, so there are always ways around pretty much anything. When you think about something like Unreal Engine or CryEngine or one of those, you know, they're very all-encompassing. You know, you can't just say, oh, I'm going to use this engine, but for networking, I'm going to use my own thing. You know, and that may not be as easy as you might think. Because those engines are about, okay, I'm going to build a game, and I'm going to build it using all these sets of tools and, you know, letting the engine take care of all the plumbing. So... So for math libraries, you know, again, you have things, you have structures and functions to deal with vectors and matrices, also colors, which you can kind of treat like vectors, but you know, they have their own little things. Like colors have red, green, and blue, and then the alpha could be transparency or could be not. You know, there are things like pre-multiplied alpha colors, you know, which is an interesting concept, which makes no sense in vectors in general and so on. So the colors get their own little structure there. But pretty much all of them get all the same sort of operations, you know, add and multiply and all those goodies. You have other, again, you know, it's getting more esoteric, but you have quaternions and, you know, so a type for quaternions. Again, quaternions is one way to represent rotations instead of using a matrix. It is interesting for various reasons, especially when it comes to animation. They are very, very useful. And then you have things like 3D planes, right? Yes. Saying, hey, you know, there's like this wall, you know, infinite plane. You know, you can do things like test whether I'm on this side of that or that side of the wall, that sort of thing. Okay. Spherical harmonics, which is a sort of functional analysis on a sphere, on the surface on a sphere, which is very useful for things like lighting formulas. And then, you know, there are other things like, you know, 16-bit floats, which CPUs support. So there are functions to manipulate those numbers because they're not your normal C++ floats. There's a function to extract the Fresnel formula, which is one specific lighting effect. You know, if you ever look at somebody's skin and you see that, you know, it's kind of brighter around the edge, you know, then, you know, that's a sort of Fresnel effect. And, well, that's pretty much all I wanted to say about it. You know, just embrace the math library. Please use it as much as you want. And go ahead and use everything else. I mean, things like, you know, load texture from memory, or load texture from file, or, you know, those functions are useful. They are very slow for what you could do yourself. So, that is all I had to say about that. Any questions?
You said some parts of D3DX are going to good performance, but
yeah.
How do you know
which parts? It's experience. It is experience. I mean, what I would say is all the math library is good. It's not the fastest, okay, but it's not too bad. There's actually a new one that they created for Xbox and also backported to the PC, which is called XNA Math, which I believe you can download from Microsoft website, which is faster, definitely. You know, it's optimized for performance. It's very similar in many ways. It doesn't have the same functions. I don't think it has anything for spherical harmonics, for instance. But
yes. XNA Math was is managed code or is also native?
No, it's native code. Native? No, in managed you have XNA basically. Yeah, I know. Parenthesis for trivia. So XNA. What is XNA? Anybody venture a guess? What is XNA?
I always like managed code, so the portability between PC and Xbox is easier.
See, XNA is not managed code. No. XNA is a concept that came about a long time ago at Microsoft, and it has veered left and right and up and down, and right now nobody knows exactly which way it's going. Actually, by now we do know it's not the way we wanted it to go, apparently. So XNA was, you know, the Microsoft services for gaming, right? It's kind of like DNA with an X for DirectX. Whatever. The problem is that, you know, we actually never, like, put it together or had, like, a good vision and actually realized it or anything like that. So out of that, what came out was XNA Framework and XNA Game Studio. That is the first and really only product that has come out of the whole XNA thing. That's why everybody thinks that's XNA. And it is, because everybody thinks it is. Okay. when you go to a bookstore and you say, you know, making games with XNA, right? And they don't say XNA Game Studio or XNA Framework, then, you know, the battle is lost. For a while, I was in the XNA team, although I was never involved with Game Studio or XNA Framework. You know, at that point, XNA was all game-related services provided by Microsoft, all of them. And if you have my cards, which I think most of you took one, in December, then you'll see that it says XNA. and I was working on D3D for Xbox. That was it. So yeah, Microsoft kind of tried to say, hey, you know, all, you know, Direct3D and Direct Input and, you know, the Xbox SDK and, you know, the Windows gaming SDK and, you know, games for Windows Live and all those things are kind of XNA, but it just didn't work that way. So today, XNA is Game Studio and XNA Framework, which is built on Managed Code, but it doesn't mean it is Managed Code. If that makes sense.
If you
program in Silverlight, that has nothing to do with XNA, and that is Managed Code, just like XNA is. You know, if you program in WinForms, that's also Managed Code. If you make Windows Presentation Foundation, which is kind of like Silverlight on steroids, then you're using Managed Code, but has nothing to do with XNA. What XNA is a set of libraries built on .NET and Managed Code that are available on several platforms. Together with a bunch of utilities to make games for those platforms. And right now those platforms are Windows, Xbox, and Windows Phone.
Do you see it as useful now?
XNA? Oh yeah, it is super useful. It is actually very, very nice to work with. Much nicer than Directory 9. Much, much nicer. Especially if you go to XNA 4. Which is what we have on the phone and, you know, works on Xbox and Windows.
Should we be using that instead of D3D?
Well, there's been talk about that, but the thing is, it's C#, it's very Microsoft lopsided. So we're not doing it. I mean, last year there was one person that did his game project in XNA, and I let him. It was an interesting experience. And it is very, very valid. These days I'm working mostly with XNA making games. For Windows Phone or for the Xbox. It is the development platform to make games for Windows Phone. Okay, you can use XNA or Silverlight, and I would not recommend making a game in Silverlight. It can be done. It has been done. I do not recommend it except for the most, you know, like user interfacey games. Yeah, with Silverlight, you know, you don't have much control about performance, and it's very, very easy to get bad performance, just because of, you know, the way it's handled. You know, it's all very data driven. So, when we talk about scene graphs, which is one of the topics in later week, you know, Silverlight is precisely that, taken to the ultimate level. And for some things, it's actually very, very nice. We'll see if today's recording works, because it is a little program in Silverlight that I made that's recording on my phone right now. You know, I still don't have the part that actually uploads it to my server so I can get it back. it's not quite working yet, but I'm hoping it will. The thing that I'm most afraid of is that my phone is going to run out of battery. We'll see. Any other questions?
Yes. Is XNA framework being used today in any big files game AAA title?
AAA title?
Yeah.
For what platform?
For Xbox.
For Xbox? No, for Xbox you can only use it for to create indie games, which are the games that you self-publish. And some of those are pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. you know, there's a lot of chaff just because anybody can publish there. You know, there's a very low barrier of entry. But, you know, and that's not no different than iPhone or Android or whatever. Or Windows for that matter. Yeah, I mean, there are professional companies that have decided to work that market. And then you can also make Xbox Live Arcade, which is it's the downloadable games. Mm. And there have been best sellers that were actually written in XNA. No. No, right now you cannot create a game and get it on an Xbox disc if you make it in XNA.
Is there plans to change it?
Mm-hmm. I will not comment about any rumors or future plans of Microsoft. Whether or no the answer or not.
So currently there's no public information on
the media. No. More questions? Okay. So, I also wanted to talk about the GPU in general. Just forgetting that it's D3D, OpenGL, or XNA, or whatever. Okay. You know, talk about this chip that we're actually going to be using, and sometimes abusing. Mm. The first thing that I need to understand is that the GPU itself is a state machine. That's why Direct3D is a state machine. Mm. We talked about state quite a bit. Mm. And so that's not capricious of Microsoft to have done that in Direct3D. GPUs do work that way. You know, it's like a piece of hardware. It has a bunch of registers. You populate those registers with values, and then you say go. It goes and performs some task. And then once it's done, you populate those registers with other different values, and then you say go, and it performs a different task. And it does those tasks serially. Mm. The types of registers that it has are registers to where a texture it is in memory, you know, or what my blend state should be. Or what should I do with the pixels once they have been rasterized? Mm. All those things. Even more important, you know, where am I going to put those pixels once they have been processed? You know, where is my final image that I'm rendering in memory? So. I guess I'm repeating myself a little bit, you know, but there is a lot of complexity involved in managing all these states correctly. Mm. Sometimes these pieces of hardware have incompatibilities. Mm. I remember way, way back when there were some graphics cards made by a company called Matrox. That was a very long time ago. They were fast. They were pretty nice. But they had one teeny tiny little drawback. Okay, just one little thing. Okay. And it's this. So, you have alpha blending, right? That's because when you populate a color, It has the red, green, and blue, and then a fourth component, which is the alpha channel, that indicates how transparent, right? Well, the back end of the GPU, you know, at the end when the pixels are generated, also sometimes populates yet another value, you know, a fifth value, which is a fog value. And the idea of the fog is this. So you're going to render, like, New York City, right? That is a lot to render, okay? Lots of buildings, lots of detail everywhere, okay? So at some point you have to limit that. So how do you do that? How do you limit how much you render? The old school way of doing it is to say, oh, I can only see, I don't know, 100 yards. Anything that's beyond 100 yards, I can't see. And that is a very, very good way of limiting what you render, because it's always, you know, whatever is in that little scope of vision. The problem is, as you move through the city, say you're like driving through the city, you know, like buildings pop up because they come within 100 yards. And that is not, it's not a pleasant sight, okay, just having things pop up suddenly. So what they came up with is say, hey, you know, we could say that, you know, it's a foggy day in New York City. And the idea is that we're not going to render anything beyond the 100 yards, okay, and anything between 150 yards, say, okay, we're going to flatten their colors to whatever is the sky color. So that anything that's at 90 yards is almost not visible, because it's, you know, if the sky is blue, you know, then that thing is mostly blue, right? And as it goes towards 100, you know, it kind of fades and disappears. What that does is avoids the popping, the sudden popping of things. And they say, hey, you know, this kind of looks like it's foggy. So that's why they called it fog. So the way this fog works is there is a color, which is global for the entire screen. That is the fog color. You know, usually whatever is your background, your sky. And then for every pixel, you know, an extra value is generated, which is how fogged that pixel will be. And that value is just used to linearly interpolate between the color that the pixel should have and the fog color, in whichever range that you have specified. Okay. Any doubts about any of this? I mean, it's not a very complex type of thing, and I'm sure we've all seen it in games. The thing is, computers and, you know, always like powers of two. And having a fifth value going with a pixel is kind of silly. At least that's what people at Matrox thought, I suppose. Because they said, we're going to reuse the alpha for this. Because, you know, most things that you render are opaque anyway. So there you go. You know, just everything's opaque. Everything that's opaque, you know, it's not using the alpha. So we're going to use it for fog. The problem is, when you actually want to render something that is transparent, you know, that has alpha transparency, but you also want it fogged, okay? You can only do one or the other. So, again, you know, this is one of those cases of incompatibilities. Suddenly, in that particular chip, you couldn't render something with alpha blending, also have it with the fogging enabled, because it didn't work. You know, basically what it did is it instead of alpha blending, did an alpha testing, and, you know, just, you know, fogged it anyway. Which, you know, did cause pops, and, you know, it didn't look quite right. But they say, hey, you know, this is our best effort with the hardware we have. So anyway, just be aware that there can be such incompatibilities. Now with profiles, the profile itself defines what is compatible and what isn't. So, you know, it means it's just documented somewhere. And if a chip cannot do it, then it doesn't actually match the profile at all. Okay. We already talked about redundant states. You know, setting state over and over again, you know, can be hurtful. Directory kind of takes care of that for us. But of course, it makes Directory D work more. The GPU can also be seen as a sequential processor, okay, because all the things that it draws, all the tasks that it performs, are done one after the other. In real life, they have some pipelining, right? So it's finishing the rendering of some triangles, and it's beginning, you know, the rendering of the next raw primitive at the same time, you know. So it has some pipelining, but it's minimal. You can kind of ignore it. I mean, it doesn't really affect you. What does affect you is that even though all GPUs were like that, you know, you just set registers and then say go, and then, you know, once it's done, you know, wait until it's done and then set more registers and then say go. Okay, and that's what D3D would do under the hood. Nowadays, all GPUs have a command processor. What that does is, you know, allows the CPU, your program, Directory D, you know, when you call it, to just fill up commands in a circular buffer, in a FIFO queue. And those commands are set register blah to value yada, okay, and, you know, go, it's another command, and so on and so forth. What this means for you is what I was talking about earlier. There is a disconnect between, in time, you know, between when your game is doing all its rendering, calling Direct3D, and when the actual rendering happens. And that affects your games in two ways. One of them is it increases latency. Okay, who here knows what latency is? Okay, what is it?
Delay.
It's a delay. Yes.
Want to start something? Start.
What is latency in a game? You know, like a game latency.
The time that I push a button in the control and it reacts on the screen.
Exactly. So, I mean, there are various kinds of latencies that you could talk about in a game. Network ping, you know, all sorts of things like that, you know, but ultimately, all games have a certain stake in the latency between when the user presses fire and when the guy dies on the screen, right? Okay? And in Windows, there are not very many ways of controlling this latency. There are several things that contribute to it, and you can consider it to be maybe 100 milliseconds. You know, it's a good ballpark. You know, that's not a bad latency at all. It's not the best. I recently was working on the Halo code base, and latency there, you know, was always meant to be 66 milliseconds. Which is very aggressive. But in the end, you know, it's not something that you can control, but it's something that affects the people who play your game. So it's something worth thinking about now and then. And this disconnect between the GPU and the CPU just adds to the latency. The idea is that the GPU should have plenty of work to do while your game is off doing artificial intelligence and running the physics and doing all those things that have nothing to do with rendering. So just be aware of that. There is always going to be some contention within these queue, right? And every single queue that you ever possibly encounter in programming has some contention. And by contention, I mean either the queue empties up, so somebody has to wait for the queue to get stuff, or the queue fills up, so you can't put any more. You know, you have to wait until it empties. Okay? That happens always. So typically the way this works on GPUs is that the CPU will wait at some point. If you measure the time that all your draw calls take on the CPU, you'll find that now and then there is one that takes some amount of time. Okay? And that is possibly because it's the one that's waiting. Usually that will be percent. But it doesn't have to be. Yeah. So this is actually a very, very interesting and good question. So Direct3D guarantees to you, okay, that there are not going to be more than two full frames in that queue. Okay. So if you render one frame and then render another one and then render another one, you know, and D3 lets you through, it's because the GPU has started rendering, you know, the first one at least. Okay. If the GPU hasn't, then that's where D3 will make you wait. Now, making you wait might sound like a bad thing, right? It's like, hey, you know, I want my game to get through, right? I don't want D3 to make me wait. But if you think about it, okay, if your display is running at 60 frames per second, you know, your actual screen, okay, it never makes sense to render more than 60 frames per second. Because if you render more, then some of those frames are never going to get seen. It's wasted work. And the only, so what that happens is if your game is running perfectly fine, okay, your game loop is going to take 1/60th of a second. If your game is rendering at 60. Okay. And the only way for it to take precisely 1/60th of a second is that at some point it actually waits and synchronizes with something else. Ultimately, the clock that's driving that is the TV, you know, your monitor. You know, from there, you know, the GPU also has to wait at some point there for it, and the CPU probably is waiting for the GPU. That is the typical way. Also, this latency is pretty nice, because if at some point your game starts taking more than the 60th of a second, say, to generate a frame, you know, then it will basically be allowing the GPU to catch up, you know, so that delay decreases. It acts as a buffer, you know. If the CPU forever, you know, takes more than a 60th of a second to render, then your display is going to be at less than 60 frames a second. Obviously, because there are not that many frames available anymore. Because the CPU is a bottleneck there. But if the GPU is running behind and the CPU starts, you know, going slow for a few frames and then recovers, then the buffering can swallow that. So, yeah.
What do you mean by the CPU waiting? Do you mean like some thread? In a processor?
So in Direct3D, there are some topics related to multi-threading and so on. But ultimately, you should always be rendering only from one thread. Some thread, but only from one.
Your callback just won't come
through. Huh?
Your callback just won't come around.
Exactly. You call, you know, D3D device, draw primitive UB, and suddenly it takes 5 milliseconds, and you're like, why was it so slow? It wasn't slow, it was just waiting. You know, it was just being throttled. because it was running too far ahead of the GPU or something, something such. And that is a good thing. The one place where that bites you in the ass is if at some point the CPU is waiting for the GPU because the GPU is far behind, and then at some point else, you know, the GPU is waiting for the CPU because it's not sending commands fast enough. Mm-hmm. And that sort of thing can happen. That's where, you know, your game is not running at its peak efficiency. Basically, both the CPU and the GPU could, like, do all the work in a 60th of a second, because they're ping-ponging who is waiting between the two, you're not hitting 60 frames a second anyway. And that sort of thing is bad. It's hard to see on PCs. You know, it's pretty easy to see on Xbox, just because of the level of access to the hardware. So, and I wouldn't venture guesses about other platforms. So, but it's always good to, like, at least have that in the back of your mind. You know, if your frame rate is not good, okay, so why is it? Who is the bottleneck, and so on and so forth. We'll talk more about performance. But
you see putting a GPU core on a CPU chip improving the situation, or not?
Not particularly. What that does is it's a convenience for hardware manufacturers more than anything else. Like, you know, the thing that Steve Ballmer was touting on the CES keynote, I don't know if anybody saw it. You know, he was talking about Windows 8 and how it works on SoCs, right? And it's like, SoC means system on chip. It means, you know, CPU, GPU, memory controller, everything, you know, in one chip. Especially one chip that goes to, you know, the memory chips and goes to, you know, the USB bus and goes to everywhere. But it's one chip that does everything. That is very common on phones. It's very common on, you know, the later iterations of game consoles. You know, like the PS2 got the slimline because they got the SoC. You know, the latest version of the Xbox is also SoC. But
360.
It's one of the things that make it so quiet. So what I think that's interesting to start to get very, very aware of is how the GPU does its rendering. So you give it vertices, right? I mean, if you've been working on the homework, you've had to deal with that. You had to create vertices and somehow tell Direct3D and by proxy tell the GPU how those vertices are built up. The GPU will then have to convert those vertices into whatever it uses internally. It will perform some calculations on them. Like, for instance, if you're rendering an actual 3D mesh, you've given it a world matrix, right? So it takes that world matrix and does magic, you know, to your vertices with it, and so on. And the thing that does that is the vertex pipeline. Okay. And the vertex pipeline in this Direct3D9, you have a choice of two. You have the fixed function vertex pipeline and you have vertex shaders. And fixed function is just, oh, I set a few values like the world matrix and the view matrix and so on. And Direct3D guarantees that the GPU will do certain things with them in certain ways. And it's just like a black box machine with sliders and switches and toggles where I can manipulate. Vertex shader is like writing a program, writing the calculations yourself. The GPU has a very, very efficient you know, all GPUs nowadays, you know, have a very, very efficient, basically micro CPU in there that can run really, really fast and do all those computations on all your bases. And you write this in something that is very, very similar to C++. No. Then, once it's converted those vertices, you know, it has to assemble them into triangles. Every triangle uses three of them. You know, usually either you specify that those vertices should be used as a vertex strip or something like that, or you just provide all the indices. You know, so every three indices is one triangle. You say, oh, get vertex 0, 2, and 20. And that makes one triangle, and so on and so forth. And you just specify it yourself in data. Mm-hmm. So the GPU basically needs to gather that and get the result from transforming those vertices for three of them for every triangle. Okay. Then he has to cut those triangles into what's called the view frustum. And, you know, we should start talking about this. Who here has never heard about that thing, the view frustum? Okay, probably Dan mentioned that. Yeah, okay. So you know what it is? It's basically the part of the universe that is visible on the screen. That's what it is. You know, and it's kind of like a pyramid truncated, right? So if I'm looking out that way, you know, it's like a pyramid like this, but not the very tip, not the closest, you know, not this. Okay. You know, cut it. Yeah, I mean, parallel projection is a perfectly fine thing for certain purposes, but it's not the way, like, you know, actual 3D scenes are rendered.
The view frustum is a truncated pyramid.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so if you have a pyramid, you know, it starts here and goes like that, you know, if say, you know, you make this pyramid smaller and smaller, right? Like, narrower, you know, the limit of it is that it's not a pyramid anymore, it's kind of like a line, you know, just imagine instead that, you know, instead of just closing down the size of the screen to the tiniest little, you know, sliver in front of me, just imagine that, you know, I'm actually moving backwards at the same time. You know, what ends up happening in some sort of limit, you know, if we go to infinity and so on and so forth, is that, you know, if your frustum ends up being a corridor of space.
Functions for an orthographic
projection? Yes. So, and, you know, that can be useful. You know, I haven't really used it much ever, but anyway, you know, those triangles have to be cut because we can't render outside the screen. You know, that's one of the reasons. Another one is that the math, once those triangles get too close to the point of origin of the observer, you know, the camera, the math kind of breaks apart. You know, there's a singularity there in the math. So, you know, that's one reason to cut it, at least on that near plane. In reality, what happens is GPUs don't cut it on the frustum. They cut it on a very, very wide frustum. And then they just reject the pixels that are outside the screen. That's how it's really implemented. You know, the main reason for doing that is that this clipping can be very, very expensive because it's, you know, this clipping of one triangle, you know, can generate either one triangle or two or three or four, you know, or five, depending on what is cutting off the view frustum. So it's kind of inconvenient. Then comes the rasterizer. So once we have one triangle with three points, this triangle has to be rasterized. And what that means is the GPU has to find the pixels that lie within that triangle on the screen. That's what it is. So this is very important, and this is the theme for the homework this week, in case anybody hadn't quite noticed yet. So the rasterizer gets three vertices and generates any number of pixels. Right? So I need to render all these pixels, super them. Then those pixels have to be converted to colors, because that's what we see on an image. Okay. Those pixels have things like texture coordinates, have things like normals. Then this pixel pipeline, which again can be either a fixed function, which is the texture stage states, or a pixel shader, which is basically the same thing as the vertex shader. It's a program that you can make up yourself. And what it does is it takes all that data that makes up a pixel and calculates what the color for that pixel is, and that's what goes out into the screen. And those colors are applied to that screen, maybe with alpha blending or things like that. Okay. Any questions about all the steps that the GPU takes your data through?
When you say vertex shader, it doesn't have anything to do with color or stuffing it. Where the vertex gets transformed to?
Well, vertex shader has to do with whatever you want it to have to do in some ways. Okay. So what happens here is the vertex pipeline, will generate the positions of the vertices on the screen. Actually in clip space, but who's counting? We haven't gotten there yet. So it generates the positions of the vertices, but also generates attributes that those vertices have. Okay. For instance, one typical calculation that the vertex shader or the vertex pipeline does is lighting. It takes that vertex and says, according to the scene or where the sun is supposed to be, and what the what part of the three mesh it is, and so on and so forth, it says, I'm gonna generate what's the light at that point? The idea is that lighting calculations, can be expensive. So you can generate them at the vertices, and then everything that you generate in the vertex shader or the vertex pipeline that is not the actual position of the vertices in space, all those are attributes. When you're working with shaders, for instance, the GPU never has any to know absolutely anything about them. They are like opaque values to the GPU, okay? They only have the meaning that you give them, okay? So you can put out three values, which are the red, green, and blue components of, the light at that point in the object. All those values, all those attributes on those vertices, the rasterizer interpolates within a triangle. It says, hey, if I have a triangle here, this is not the best pen, but if I have a triangle here, okay, and my light is kind of bright over here and dark over here and over here, okay, what is the light here, right? And that's interpolation. Okay, this is a little bit of math. You'll learn all about it. The idea here is that if we calculate those lights on the vertex shader, okay, then we can get interpolated light values in the pixel shader, okay. And then, you know, we apply the texture. It's like, okay, this light, you know, what does it look like with this coloring texture? And that's, you know, on every pixel and so on and so forth. Okay. Or we have another choice, which is instead of passing on the light values into the pixel shader, so the vertex shader outputs those values here, they get interpolated and they go in the pixel shader. So in a way, it's kind of like, you know, the values from the vertex shader, you know, get exported and then imported by the pixel shader. Although the pixel shader doesn't get the precise values that the vertex shader generates, it gets the interpolated values. Okay? But it's like, you know, if you put those values in the structure, it's the same structure that goes out of one, gets into the other. Okay? The GPU just doesn't pay attention to any meanings because it doesn't know. And it just interpolates every single value that you put in there. Okay? So the idea there is, you could choose, hey, instead of passing in the value of the light at the vertices, I could pass in from the vertex shader all the values that the lighting formulas need in order to calculate the light. If you interpolate those, then you can run the lighting calculations on every pixel in the pixel shader. So you can choose what to do in the vertex shader and what to do in the pixel shader. So the vertex shader has to calculate the positions. Absolutely. Everything else, honestly, is optional. One of the things that, you know, we've been seeing in games on Xbox and on the phone and everywhere, you know, is when people use shaders, they tend to end up moving things to the pixel shader. You know, like, because it looks better. Okay? The later that you actually do the calculation, the more precise it's going to be.
So one thing you're saying is, instead of,
so,
like, you calculate the normal at each vertex, you do the light, and then interpolate that, I think it's like broad shading. Give the normal, interpolate that.
Exactly. Give the normal, get the normal interpolated by the rasterizer, and then each pixel gets a normal.
And that's like
wonky. Yeah.
Exactly. Or even more than that, you can add more than just the normal.
Yeah. So, I mean, but the interesting part of that is that anything that you do per pixel, you can do per vertex. And then it's faster because there are less vertices than pixels. I mean, that's the general wisdom. Okay? It doesn't have to be. You know, you render a million polygon mesh and occupies 3 pixels, then You're not doing things right. It happens. Okay? It happens. I've seen it in games, in real ones. It's like, dude. What do you mean? Well, it kind of matters. I mean, when you render a mesh, okay, and say, I don't know, you render a mesh that represents the Parthenon. You know what I mean, right? It's a big house with lots of columns, right? So imagine that you're looking in such a way that, you know, you only see one column because all the other ones are behind it, you know. So, but you're rendering all of them. You know, which one gets rendered first by the GPU? You don't know, maybe you do. I mean, usually the wisdom says that, you know, the primitives are rendered from first to last. But that's not completely and entirely true, okay? So when there are overlaps, okay, sometimes maybe one gets rendered in front of the other one, and some other times it's the other way around. Honestly, GPUs try to make sure that they don't have any randomness in how things happen inside the GPU, because that helps. But, you know, ultimately, you know, you don't really know what's being rendered first and what's being rendered last. You know, there's no guarantees.
Does the rasterization happen after everything's translated to screen space so that the rasterization has the same, basically the same screen?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, the rasterizer just has a triangle at a time. Or there could be 1,000 rasterizers, each one of them doing one triangle, all in parallel. For all you care, okay? Rasterization of triangles is completely independent from each other. But yeah, I mean...
I just meant when the triangle's far away, it rasterizes to fewer pixels.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but that's just because, you know, when you transform the vertices into screen space, you know, they end up with a small triangle instead of a big one. So, but yeah, I mean, rasterization logically has to happen in screen space because it is finding the pixels on the screen. Actually, that's not entirely always true. There was this game console called the Sega Saturn. I don't know if people have seen it. So the Sega Saturn had three capabilities, okay, but they were kind of fake. You know, if you render a triangle too big, you know, you actually see it, you know, it's like like one of those blinds, you know, if you kind of stretch it a lot, suddenly you can see the cracks between them. You know, it was very weird. It didn't render triangles, it rendered the rectangular patches. So it is weird, but anyway. That was because it was meant to just do sprites, but they actually tweaked it so it could actually, you know, twist the sprite, you know, so basically specify all four corners independently. So it could take any shape whatsoever, and then they figured, oh, you can do 3D with that. What do you know?
So would it be okay to say that the rasterizer is what is converting the triangles from world space?
No, the rasterizer doesn't do that. The rasterizer only gets the vertices in screen space.
In screen space?
Yes. Okay. So, that happens here, in the vertex shader. Okay. There's actually one little step that happens right after, because the vertex shader has to output not screen coordinates, but normalized clip space coordinates, which we will talk about. And then there's a little thing that converts that into screen space, but the conversion is just like a, you know, triangle rule. I mean, it's nothing. Yeah?
How the rasterizer decides?
How
the rasterizer decides, yes, this pixel is of this triangle, this pixel is not of this triangle.
Oh. What you're asking is, how do I do the homework? Yes, and it's a good question. Let's leave it for, you know, when we talk about the homework. Okay? You have anybody? No. Okay. Well, this is just another try at putting in front of you what type of state goes. So what's the pixel shader, right? What's the vertex shader? What is the parameters to that you can give the rasterizer, things like that, okay? So in general, it's all the parameters that allow the GPU that the GPU allows you to have some configurability on within that pipeline. These two today are completely programmable, and the rest are fixed functions. So you just have to know the functions and deal with them, okay? Ultimately, you can do whatever you want with this, okay? It's just a machine, right? You know, it's been abused in various ways. I mean, people use this in order to decode video and things like that, so... you can only do that sort of thing when you know it well. You know, you're very, very proficient in how things go through the pipeline.
Can you go back to the timing question?
Yeah.
Do you see any advantage to programming other parts of the
Okay, so could we program everything instead of... well, have you heard of Larvae?
No.
Okay, Larvae is a product that has been announced and described by Intel. They've been working on it for a while, and you know, it's a very interesting take on making a GPU. You know, Intel wants to make a next generation GPU by basically having it in a chip, say 32 CPUs, and having them do the work. and yeah, I mean, the concept is theoretically sound. I haven't seen one yet, so I don't know. But in theory, you know, it might work. The only problem there is performance, you know, that the performance actually gives and so on. I mean, when you have a CPU and it's accessing memory and you have 32 and they're all accessing memory, you know, there are issues there, you know, that I'm sure they have to iron out. But, you know, basically what they said is, you know, they're taking the old original Pentium architecture, which is a very, very simple little CPU that can do a lot. And, you know, they can say, hey, you know, we can put 32 in a chip. And so what can we do with that? And they said, oh, GPU, graphics. So there you go.
Hmm.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Hmm? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an SOC, basically. Okay, I didn't know they had discontinued the Larvae. That's a pity. That's like a sexy little machine to work with recently. But. I mean, I know that at some point they said, you know, they had like a first version that they wanted to productize, and they canceled that, and they said, no, you know, we're going to just use it for prototyping, and we'll productize the next one. So at that point, you know that the project is not going all that well. But but yeah, I mean, hey, you know, you can have a single CPU do the rendering, which you can see in the homework project that I give you. You know, and you'll end up having full source code for that, so you can actually play with it, and you know, it does everything in some way or another. So the really interesting parts are the vertex and pixel pipelines, okay? Because that's where you can program everything. And you know, when you start wanting to do crazy things like shadows or, you know, very interesting kinds of lighting and things like that, you know, it becomes very useful to just be able to program it and be done with it. This is what I was talking about. You know, sometimes you can, you know, there are plenty of calculations that you can choose whether to do on the vertices or on the pixels. You know, if you do it on the vertices, then there is no real variation between, you know, within a triangle, because it's just pure interpolation. When you do them on the pixels, then there can be plenty of variation within a triangle. You know, that's why textures are sampled in the pixel shader, in the pixel pipeline. Because, you know, you want the image to actually look reasonable, right? but that's basically the balancing act that you have. I did say that typically, you know, there are much less vertices than pixels when you render mesh. There are, you know, the horrible cases of, you know, like 8 vertices of a cube and 200,000 pixels, right? Which means if you're doing very important calculations on the vertices, you're not going to see anything. Okay. And you have the opposite case, which is 1,000,000 vertices and 2 pixels. Right? And at that point, you're wasting performance like there's no tomorrow. Okay. So, you know, it's always good to try to keep a balance between the two. You know, say, I don't know, 20 pixels per vertex or, you know, whatever number you come up with. You know, it's all a matter of balancing performance and quality, right?
Is that something they regularly do, where you
compute the distance and then say run the shader or run the shader.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, hey, if it's not important enough, then you shouldn't do the work. Or rather, you know, the computer or the console shouldn't do the work. You know, you have a limited amount of performance. What are you going to use it for? You know, it's a budgeting thing. So yeah, you think about games like Grand Theft Auto or you know Crackdown, or Prototype, and you know those are games where you can like you know, move throughout the city anywhere you want, and there's no fogging, so you can always see very far away. You know, but of course you know when you see very far away, you're not seeing you know what you would see if you actually went there in the game, right? You know, you're seeing just a box. Or a building, maybe. So, and that's what's called level of detail, LODing. You know, basically figuring out what is important to do in higher resolution or higher precision, higher quality, and what isn't.
So, one thing I've noticed in Halo 3 is you do have some popping with, like, the flowers and some of the outdoor scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And I always kind of find that a little annoying.
Well, yeah, I would think so. I mean, games like Grand Theft Auto, okay, they're called sandbox games. You can go anywhere, do anything at any time. You know, it's like full freedom. You know, and when you make a game like that, you have to start being very careful about those things because there's no way you can test all scenarios that are going to happen. So you tend to be meticulous about things. You make a game like Halo, which is basically you go on a fixed path, you know, from A to B, you know, in a level. Then you would think that because it's more structured, you know, you could, you know, you could test the heck out of it and make sure that nothing untoward ever happens. You know, but in practice, you know, you just don't pay as much attention. I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, that's reasonable, that things pop up inappropriately and so on, but, you know, it does happen, definitely. Another way to see it, maybe, could be that a game like Grand Theft Auto, okay, if something happens that is not perfect, you say, well, you know, this is a sandbox game, you know, you can do anything and anything can happen, so... You don't think twice of it, you know. With a game like Halo, which is more directed, you know, it's like, okay, they're directing me here, and it's popping. So, maybe you just notice more. I don't know. Okay, let's make a pause and. Let's come back at, let's do 10 minutes. Yeah, it's been almost 2 hours. I shouldn't touch this. Ooh. Hey, this is still recording. Still have the battery, so it's gonna be good.
Homeworks to do Saturday morning, just like last
quarter. Huh?
Homeworks to do Saturday morning,
just like right, 10 a.m.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah, Saturday morning, 10 a.m. So, yeah, this Saturday is last week's homework. It's due. Yeah. That's right. Thank you for letting me know.
Oh, yeah, no problem.
Oh. You know what? I did something very cool with this little recording program. Okay. Let's hope the recording continues correctly. It should. So, Oh, the screen is a little low, huh? There. That's more simple. So, last topic that I'm going to try to get through with you is the vertex pipeline and a little bit of what comes afterwards. I did mention that the vertex pipeline, the only thing it absolutely has to do, and everything else is ultimately optional, is generate the position. The position of the vertices for the rest of the pipeline to deal with. Okay? And it does whatever magic it needs to. You know, it could pull them out of a hat, you know, for all we care. I mean, I've seen meshes that only have, like, a number, right? You know, you give it a, you know, you have a mesh, right? And every vertex is just an integer. Mm-hmm. If the vertex shader can get that integer and somehow generate meaningful positions from that, it's fine. It works. Okay? But of course, that's not what typically happens. Okay? That sort of thing is rare. I mean, I've seen it happen. I've done it. But usually what happens is your vertices contain some sort of position in some frame of reference. Mm-hmm. And what the vertex pipeline has is information about how to transform the vertices from that frame of reference into some standardized frame of reference that the GPU knows about. So it can take it from there. Okay? And that special frame of reference that the GPU can deal with, you know, is of course a frame of reference that relates to the screen. Because that's what the GPU needs to do is go from there into just putting pixels on the screen. So, the frame of reference in which your vertices have been expressed, it's called model space, local space. Every object that you render has its own. Let's say we're making a racing game, and there are 8 cars on the road. Each car has its own sort of local space, has its own local frame of reference. When you have a mesh, say a .x file on the disk that represents a car, it is expressed in a local frame of reference. No matter where the car is on the road, the vertices is always the same. Okay?
Quick question.
Yes. Yeah, it has to handle animation. Okay. So, but the thing is, you know, animation is one full slide deck of its own. Okay. And how to deal with it. And animation of skinning, of like hierarchical animation is another one. So, you know, we'll get to that.
Oh, I just wanted to know if it was part in this.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, you know, if you're rendering a character, okay, the hand has to be defined in some frame of reference,
right,
you know, which is local to the hand. Mm-hmm. And then when, you know, I animate and dance around and do whatnot,
so
that has to be handled here because this vertex pipeline has to generate the final coordinates of the vertices of the hand, okay, in what's called clip space.
Mm-hmm. Was the deformation of the mesh done in CPU that now you're saying it's on the GPU?
Yeah. It is perfectly possible to do all of this on the CPU, right? You could take a list of vertices and you can convert them into another list of vertices that are already transformed in clip space. And then your vertex shader in the GPU has nothing to do. And that's sometimes actually a useful thing to do. Okay? Say for instance that in order to render your mesh, you have to render it three times for some reason. Say for instance that you're running a game in split screen with four screens, right? You know, four players on the same computer or console playing the same game. And they're looking at the same thing, right? And that thing is animating because it's a monster, right? Then the animation of the monster, maybe you want to do it in the CPU once and then render it four times for each one of the little screens. And maybe doing it once on the CPU is better than doing it four times on the GPU. Or maybe not. You know, it all depends on the particular context. With a programmable vertex shader, you can just have the vertex shader do it. Okay? If you're gonna render the same thing four times, you know, maybe with different, like, view transforms, but with the same world transforms, right? If you're gonna render it four times, maybe you want to do the world transforms first as one single pass, and then, you know, for all four of them, and then have the vertex shader do the rest. It's a little like, you know, the pixel shader and vertex shader. You know, you can balance that. You know, you can move computations one side or the other. And, you know, there's a balancing issue, of, you know, why you would want to do that. And here it's the same. You can do any computation that you want on the CPU, always. That makes your vertex shader a bypass. Just copy from here, put it here, because I don't need to do the calculations. But that's perfectly doable. Why would you want to do that? It depends on the situation. Okay? Depends on whether it's a performance issue or because, I don't know, you want to have the CPU have access to the animated mesh for other purposes. Okay? So, we have these local space, okay? The next space in the pipeline, and there are several, okay? The next space in the pipeline is the world space, okay? That's the space where, you know, the track is, you know, in a racing game is defined, right? It's the, like, the glue that puts all spaces together, okay? Any model with its own local space, you know, can be positioned in the world. In a way, just by transforming its frame of reference from local space into world space. And you do that with the world matrix. Okay? That's the one that you've been using in the first quarter. This is what it means. Then you have the view matrix, and the view matrix transforms coordinates from world space to view space or camera space. Now, question. Would it be possible to transform directly from local space into view space? Yes or no? Yes? Yes. Yes. Take these matrix, multiply them together, and there you go. You have a matrix that transforms directly from local space into view space. That's all there is to do. I mean, multiplying matrices is the same as chaining transformations. You know, it gives you one matrix that does all in one step. Okay, so this is perfectly doable. Why would you ever want to have them separate? What is so important about world space?
It's different for each object. Whereas the view matrix is static for that one frame because it represents how to go from.
Yeah, I mean, conceptually they are different.
Yeah.
So at some point you're going to have world matrices for the different objects. Right. I mean, I have eight cars, you know, each one has a different world matrix.
Right.
But they all have the same view matrix. Okay. From a computational point of view, from, you know, I'm going to do the calculations, you know, why would you ever want to have them separate?
Bunch of matrix, several of them don't change. You could remultiply them and hold that value, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just imagine, okay? Imagine that my vertex shader takes my position, multiplies by the world matrix. And then the result goes and multiplies by the view matrix. Okay, that's two multiplications of vertex by matrix. Okay. Why not do only one? Doesn't it sound better? Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes. Typically in a vertex shader, you don't have two separate matrices, world and view. What you have is a world view matrix. It's very typical. Mm-hmm. In fact, you don't only have those, you have world view and projection, which will be the next. Okay? And you can put them all together. Mm-hmm. There are sometimes reasons to separate them though. Mm-hmm. When you're gonna do calculations, like lighting, like animation, like any sort of calculations on the vertex shader, sometimes you want to do those calculations in one particular space. Okay, sometimes you just want some specific space. Okay, world space is very sexy sometimes because, you know, it's very universal. It doesn't matter where the camera is, you know, or if the camera is following the car, world space doesn't change, you know. If there's a tree there, it always have the same coordinates in world space. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter that the cars move, that the camera moves. Mm-hmm. So, in some sense, you know, that's the perfect place to do lighting calculations. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, sometimes you will see them separate, and the reason is because you want to do some calculation in some intermediate space. If you are not going to do any calculation in an intermediate space, then you do not need the coordinates in that space. You know, you still need to know what it is conceptually and so on, but then you take the matrices, multiply them together, and bypass it completely. Like it doesn't even exist. Okay? Mm-hmm. Sometimes, quite often, lighting calculations can be done in geospace. Instead of world space, mm-hmm. just so that you can multiply those two together. Mm-hmm. What happens is, as you move around, you know, the light vectors and positions and so on change from frame to frame. That's what happens. Okay? In that space. Mm-hmm. So, view space, you understand that pretty well, I hope. So, X and Y are like this. If I'm looking at the scene, you know, these are X and Y. Okay. And the Z goes into the scene. Okay. There is a convention in OpenGL that the Z comes from the screen. Okay, so in OpenGL, the Z is different. Again, conventions. Okay. What those conventions do is, when you talk about cross products, you know, in Direct3D, you get things one way, and in OpenGL, you get it the other way, just because the space is a mirror of each other. Okay. It is said that, you know, in Direct3D, we use left-handed space, and OpenGL uses right-handed. But anyway. The projection matrix is the one that transforms from view space, which is something very easy to visualize, to clip space, which is not quite so, well, it is easy to visualize, you know, it's actually kind of four-dimensional. Okay, the projection matrix doesn't have the 0001 at the end, like all the matrices. It is different, so it will distort the fourth component. And it'll actually return a vector that has four components that are arbitrary. Okay? None of them is just always one. Mm-hmm. So it deserves a little more attention. So imagine a view first term like this, you know, seen from above. See, this is not working. There should be a black hole there. Okay. Okay, so this is me looking in that direction, and this is my view from here. And this is my near plane, so I'm not going to be able to see anything closer to me than this. And this is my far plane over here, meaning I'm not going to be able to see anything that far away. Okay? The projection matrix, okay, view space, you know, would be, this is the Z, this is the X, and, you know, this coming out is the Y, right? Say, I'm looking at it from above, okay. Clip space is very similar, in that it is like this. And this is the Z, this is the X, and this is the Y. The only difference is the scaling, okay? Projection matrix, one of the things it does is a non-uniform scale. Mm-hmm. So if I'm looking at a widescreen type of scene, you know, that's going to be rendered in widescreen, right? It doesn't matter. You know, the actual view in clip space is going to be perfectly square. No, the screen will be perfectly square. Okay. This here will always be 45 degrees. Mm. This will, another 45 degrees. Mm. No matter what that is, you know, that's why the projection matrix defines things like field of view, you know, whether you're seeing a lot or, you know, very narrow view. Because it transforms from here to here. Mm-hmm. Such that this is the far Z, okay, the far Z plane, okay, so the far Z plane in clip space is always 1, okay. So it performs a scale such as this. And it also performs a scale, you know, so if this is 45 degrees, it means that from here to here, okay, it's also 1. So this distance here is 1. What it means is on the edges of the Fieber-Frustum, in this case, you know, the X is minus Z, and here the X is Z on this one, on this edge. Okay? It's a normalized space. Basically, it takes the Fieber-Frustum and transforms it into something static. It's always the same, no matter what your Fieber-Frustum looks like. Okay? Now, this is not entirely true in that the perspective, the projection matrix takes these Z values and scales them so that they go from 0 to 1, but it doesn't put it in the Z coordinate, it puts it in the W coordinate. Okay, so this is W. The Z coordinate takes values such that this plane here is Z equals 0, and this one is Z equals 1. Mm-hmm. So the difference between the Z and the W is the ratio between the near and far planes. Sorry, not the difference as in subtracting, you know, the Yeah, this isn't correct. There should be a 1. Yeah. Anyway. I mean, that's also true. C is always less than or equal to W. Within the first term. Right? Okay. The main advantage of this is that it makes life a lot easier for the GPU. You know, it can do clipping without actually knowing where the first term is, because it knows. And it's always the same in this space. Okay. Questions so far? Yeah, just the clip space. The rest is done by the GPU. Now, when you render things with the D3D FVF, XYZRHW that we've been using, okay, well, that means you're even bypassing everything that comes after all of this. Okay, you're just giving it screen coordinates raw. Okay. You're giving it screen coordinates raw for the X and for the Y. Mm-hmm. But the Z and W should be the ones in clip space. Mm-hmm. And you also have to provide them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we use 0, which means in the end, those values are independent from each other if you don't calculate them from the same source. The Z value is used for the Z buffering. So your Z buffer normally has this range. Because that's the way we define projection matrices. Okay. So the end value of the Z is 0 here and 1 here. Which means the depth within the visible range. The W is the one that does the perspective calculations. Because, you know, it's 0 here and 1 here. And on the edges of the screen, no matter how far a point is, as long as it's on the edge of the screen, you know, the X divided by W is always the same. Make sense? So what the GPU actually does is this. You know, it takes the X and the Y and divides them by the W. Actually, no, this is true. The Z in... See, I'm already forgetting things. Okay, so yeah, the Z actually goes between 0 and the W, because the value that actually goes into the Z buffer is Z divided by W. And that's the one that's between 0 and 1. Sorry. And no vertex should ever have a W of 0 in clip space because it's not visible, right? I mean, it can, but it will be clipped out. So.
Well, it should
be divided by W. Right. That's why clipping is done in clip space, so that there will never, ever, ever be any W of 0. Okay? Because clipping happens first. See, all the GPUs, like, you know, the original Xbox GPU, for instance, the vertex shader actually provided screen coordinates instead of clip space. So clipping was kind of funny, you know, when those things happened. It did have, you know, little dark corners where things didn't work. So this is a little bit of what we've talked about already. We absolutely need some clipping, at the very least, something so that there are no vertices or no parts of any triangle in after interpolation that are so close to the camera that the W is zero. Because the math kind of breaks apart when you divide by it. What the GPU needs to do. So at the very minimum, you know, that clipping needs to happen. You know, everything else could potentially be done in screen corners. So clip space, if we take X, Y, and W, you know, it's still a linear transformation from V space. Okay, it's just simple arithmetic. It's a matrix multiplications and additions. Okay, so that's also important to understand. This is kind of like real space, only distorted, and that is stretched around in various ways. And then also it has the extra, you know, the Z value, which is used for the depth buffer computations. So this is another thing that I mentioned earlier, the guard band. You know, usually when you have a clip space like this, okay, quite often GPUs will do clipping against a wide version of it. Say one where, you know, the X, instead of it being, between negative W and positive W, you know, it's basically, say, negative 10 times W and 10 times W here. Say, you know, just wider. The idea here is any triangles, you know, if I have, so if I have a guard band like this, and I have a triangle here, I don't need to clip it, because I know that it's going to be potentially visible. Okay. But if I have a triangle that's like this, which is actually cutting this guard band, you know, but it's outside of the real frustum, then I don't need to clip it either. So it's kind of like a band over here that allows me to trivially accept or reject triangles without clipping them. And that's how GPUs typically do it. Yeah, I mean, if a triangle is completely outside of the view frustum, that's easy to trivially reject. The problem is, you know, there are triangles that actually cut the view frustum that you can say, hey, you know, as long as they're within the guard band, you know, I'm going to accept them. So what that means is I'm going to actually project into screen space, which comes after, you know, I'm going to project into the screen the vertices of the triangle, and I'm going to rasterize it. And I'll get pixels that are outside the screen, and those are easy to reject.
So the only case where you have to bring it up into more triangles is where it crosses both boundaries.
Yeah, exactly. When a triangle crosses both boundaries, so, you know, some of it is within the guard band, some of it is outside of the guard band, and some of it is inside of the first room, then yeah, it goes ahead and says, okay, I'm going to clip it. Whether it clips it against the guard band or the first room, I don't care. You know, it makes very little difference. So when clipping, you know, the typical way of doing it is just generate more triangles. So let's say, we have a frustum here, okay, and I'm clipping this triangle here, okay, what I do, you know, what the GPU needs to do is figure out those two points and then just make a new triangle like this, right? And that's it. And that triangle is entirely within, you know, the FUSU. If it has a triangle like this, okay, it still needs to figure out those two points, and then it has quad, not a triangle, so it needs to split it and render two triangles, typically. Okay. And if a triangle cuts multiple of the sides of the first term at the same time, you know, it could end up kind of ugly. Okay, 4, 5, 6 triangles. Typically, GPUs will just do the simple thing. It's like, okay, cut it against one, generate two triangles, and then clip each one separately. An easy strategy. So, there's a transformation that is not a matrix, which is the only one. Which basically all the X, Y, and Z are divided by the W. Okay? That's why it's X, Y, Z, R, H, W. R, H, W means reciprocal homogeneous W. Okay? Which is 1 over the W. Okay? When the W is between 0 and 1, it's 1 over that. You know, reciprocal homogeneous W. Mm-hmm. And that's the value that's actually put there. It's not the W itself. It's already the, you know, 1 over the W. And the reason for that is that then instead of dividing, the GPU just needs to multiply. You know, which is easier for implementations.
Floating point division is pretty expensive.
Yeah. Floating point multiplication, you know, they do them in one cycle here. You know, single shot. So, once we do that, what does projection space look like? Well, you know, the X and Y are between negative 1 and 1. Guess what? Negative 1 means the left side of the screen. Positive 1 means the right side of the screen for the X. Negative 1 means the top of the screen. Positive 1 means the bottom of the screen. Okay? Remember, the Y axis used to go up, and here it goes down. Or actually, no. That's not done yet. Sorry. Negative 1 is bottom of the screen. Positive 1 is top of the screen. Mm-hmm. And the Z in here, it goes between 0 and 1. Okay. So, with this division by W, and the critical thing here is the W is 0 at the origin of the observer, you know, the camera. This division by W, what it does is it transforms things that are in, you know, kind of world-ish space into screen-ish space. Okay. No matter where on an edge, or say the left edge of the first term, is a point, will always end up being -1. So all those points are collapsed. It's projecting them. Okay. Suddenly we have two-dimensional space instead of three-dimensional space. Okay. If that makes sense to you.
So the aspect ratio is handled in going to clip space and then fixed when we go from projection to screen space.
Hmm.
The
aspect ratio is handled later. I mean, it's handled by both the projection matrix and by what comes later, which is the viewport transformation. Another thing of importance for the homework, you know, for those of you who want to get, you know, go beyond, is that this reciprocal of the W, you know, it's kept around. You know, it's useful later on. It's useful in the rasterizer. So, and the reason is that this is what you do, you know, to make things that are, you know, linear and oriented in the world, to make them kind of linear in screen space. Okay. So, projection space was normalized negative 1 to 1 for the x and y. This is, you know, the viewport, you know, normally you set this when you do set viewport. Basically adjusts the x and y coordinates from negative 1 to 1 into 0 to, say, kind of 40, for instance, or whatever it is, the resolution of your screen. So everything that came before, including the projection matrix, you know, it basically says how space is distorted into, you know, making the view first from, you know, homogeneous space, like Euclid space. And then the viewport transformation here, you know, undoes that. And puts it back to the proper dimensions. So yeah, the two kind of need to match. You know, if you want your aspect ratio to be constant. So again, you know, matrices, you know, they can be combined for performance. You know, you don't need to multiply one by one matrix and then multiply by another and then by another. You can just multiply the matrices and get to the final result in one step. Right. Lighting can be done in world space, you know, which is the natural place to do it. Or it can be done in model space. Why not? In local space. Or in view space. The one thing... makes the lighting a little more complicated is if the world matrix has any sort of stretching in it, the view matrix should never ever have it. It's just a reorientation of the world, you know, the view matrix. But the world matrix, you know, say you have a cube and you want to make a little stick out of it, you can do a non-uniform stretch. What that means is suddenly you can't do lighting properly in model space. It just doesn't, you know, the math doesn't work because space is distorted from the world. Also, when you apply these non-uniform stretch normals, you know, if you have any normals in your braces in order to do lighting calculations, those normals have to be transformed, and they can't. They can't be transformed just like the braces themselves, the positions. No, they have to be transformed using this little trick. So basically you need to take the world matrix, you know, find the inverse of that matrix, and then transpose it. And that's the matrix that transforms the normals properly, which is a quirky little thing.
If I uniformly modified, if it was a scale and x, y, and z are the same, that's uniform. But if you're doing x, scaling x more than y, z, that's...
Yeah. If you do any scaling, okay, and you transform your normals using that matrix, which has the scaling in it, your normals will not be normalized anymore. You want them normalized, but you can renormalize them easily. You can always do that. Okay, questions? Any more? I mean, this is a little tough stuff, but...
Does this talk about any of the books you recommended?
Hmm? Yeah, I did put some references in the website. Yeah, both the math book and real-time rendering talk about, you know, various things in JMeter pipeline. Should we go to homework? Yeah. Maybe I should apologize. You know, I don't have an Xbox today. but that means we can actually talk about homework. So, yay. No. I kind of wanted to get through a lot today, and honestly, you know, I spent a little too much getting this recording program working. So, kind of went to bed at 4:30 last night, which was not 4:30 this morning, which was not reasonable. I'm actually surprised I'm so coherent today, or I hope I am, at the very least. Okay. Oh, crap. I forgot to... Okay, so... This is the homework. Little homework program. Well, maybe I should do this because it's easy. Don't forget. Come on. You can do it. Oh. We've been shifted again. Anyway. Let's just run it. I'm gonna run release because it's faster. Somewhat. First, so that I can, you know, show you how this works. What the? Oh. You know what that is? That is the antivirus program. Because I'm compiling it in the desktop and I don't have that in the exclusion list. Yeah, for a second there I got worried. So, when you run the program, this is what you see. It's not very neat. If you squint, you'll see little dots moving around. Okay? So, what you have is a function that you need to implement correctly. Okay, that function renders those dots in the correct places. Those are the vertices of a cube. Okay? If I press space, I go to different scenes, so these are the vertices of a teapot. Okay? You can see a little better. You have a teapot and you have a sphere. Okay, so I'm just spinning a sphere out there in the cube. Okay, so you press the R key. You know, you have the keys. You have them described in the web page. But you press the R key and you switch to the reference implementation, which I have in there in a little DLL that you can't look into. Okay. So this reference implementation basically contains the function that you need to implement. So it's a shame that you can't look into it. I promise I'll give you the source code. Okay? So this is just rendering triangles, right? Like there's a triangle over here. You know, and it's basically rasterizing them and interpolating everything correctly, and everything looks great. If you can get to this, you'll get lots of points. Okay, if you make it look like this, you get lots and lots of points. At the very least, what I want you is to fill the triangles with pixels of some color, okay, so that you can actually see the cube spinning, okay? So all I need you to do is to figure out how to have the rasterizer find the pixels that lie within a triangle, okay? That's all. That's the basic assignment.
I'm kind of assuming an artifact of the square being chopped into two triangles.
Yes. That is because I'm doing lighting calculations on the vertices.
Okay.
And this is one of those extreme cases that where things break apart. Okay. So I'm calculating. I can pause this. With the arrow keys, you can, you know, reset to the very beginning, okay, and go forwards and backwards and just continue the animation, which is pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
So just 1 second. So yes, there is this face of the cube has two triangles, and you can see the difference. Okay, the reason why you can see the difference is because there is one interpolation that happens in this triangle, okay, that takes into account what's in here, in this vertex, okay? And there's another interpolation in this triangle that takes into account what's in that vertex, but not this one, okay? So there's a little bit of discontinuity in the interpolations there. And if we split the triangles this way, you know, it would look different, okay? That's one of the reasons why people want to move to doing calculations on the pixels instead of the vertices. Okay, nowadays, most AAA games, they do everything in the pixels. Okay. Just figure out how to do it quickly. Take shortcuts, whatever they need. So this is the teapot. Again, you know, it's just same thing. You know, if the cube looks great, the teapot should look great. You know, it's just smaller triangles, that's all. Okay? And that's why, you know, the lighting looks better. Just because, you know, interpolation is finer. You know, the lighting calculations are done on a finer grid. The next one is a teapot that is transparent. Now, this one is very interesting because one of the most common errors, once you get the rasterizer working correctly, is not to have edge artifacts. And by edge artifacts, the most typical is that the edges between the triangles will show up more opaque over here. Okay? They will stand out. The reason for this is that it's very, very tricky to do two different calculations, basically to rasterize two triangles such that if you have, like, the grid of pixels here, right? And you have... Let me get black. And you have the edge of a triangle that mathematically should go through there, okay? If you figure that, you know, when rasterizing this triangle over here, okay, if you figure that this pixel belongs to this triangle, okay, when you rasterize this other one, you must never figure that it belongs to this triangle, okay? Because if you do, you're going to render this pixel twice, once for one triangle and again for the other triangle. When you are doing transparency like this, you know, when you put something that's kind of translucent on top of something that's kind of translucent, you get something that's more opaque than either of them, right? So, and that's why they, you know, the edges would stand out, okay? And that is very, very typical. The converse case is, oh, I figure that this pixel does not belong to this triangle, and also does not belong to the other one, and suddenly I don't render it at all, right? That's the opposite case, and it can happen. Again, the idea is that when you do math calculations, okay, however you decide whether a pixel is on this side or that side of this edge, okay, should be the precisely same calculation on both triangles. And that can be a little tricky to get properly working. And that's why it's extra credit. Okay? Of course, GPUs do it millions of times a second. But you know, it's just something for you to think about and play with. Okay? one strategy is that, you know, for instance, is, oh, when you are going, usually, I mean, when you're going to decide whether a pixel is on this side or that side of this line, okay, usually what you do is, you know, you go in the internet and you say, hey, you know, distance from point to line, right? And you take the point of the pixel, you know, like the position of the pixel, say the center, right? Every pixel will have one position, you know, it's a discrete sample of them. And you measure the distance, like, you know, for here you measure this distance, okay? And if it's positive, then it means it's seen, and if it's negative, it means it's out on the other side, right? You know, that's how it goes. So you need to use exactly the same numbers, you know, for doing this distance calculation. Exactly the same formula, whether it's one triangle or the other. So that basically means sorting the vertices exactly the same way, no matter how they're given to you. You will need to resort the vertices in some way that's consistent and always the same, no matter what triangle the vertices, you know, belong to. So the big question is, how should you go about making a rasterizer out of the blue, right? I mean, I've been explaining things, but I haven't told you how to do it. There are multiple ways of doing it. By far the simplest way is if you have a triangle. I'm always running out of space. If you have a triangle that you're trying to render, okay, find a bounding box of that triangle. Bounding rectangle. You know that there are no pixels below this point, no pixels above this point, to the right and to the left or there, that will ever belong to the triangle. And then just loop over all the pixels that remain within the triangle, okay? So it's within this bounding box, you know, within that rectangle. Just loop through them. For x equals something to something, for y equals something to something. And for every pixel, do a, is this pixel within the triangle test? If you got true, put the pixel, you know, in the output. If it says false, then don't. If you can do that right, you know, you will have a rasterizer. It's not the fastest one. I can guarantee that. But it works. That method works. Now, how do you test whether a point is within the triangle or not? Anybody venture a guess?
Do that same thing and it's all three.
Exactly. That's one of the easiest ways. Another one of the easiest ways, you know, that's also very typical, is say you have this point over here. Is it within the triangle or not? Well, trace a line, say vertical. Horizontal works too, right? It doesn't matter which direction. You just pick one that's easy. Horizontal or vertical. And figure out the intersections of that line with the edges. In this case, you will find two. One and two. If those intersections are both in the same side, you know, of this vertical line from here, from the point, it means the point is outside. If they're on either side, then it means it's inside. That's what it takes. This method is kind of fraught with peril. Mm-hmm. Because when you have these triangle and this triangle and this triangle and this triangle, and you want to find whether this point belongs to any of them, okay, and you use a vertical line like this, okay, then there could be math imprecisions here that make it say, oh, you know, maybe you only find one intersection instead of two. You know, there can't be only one. I mean, an infinite line either cuts the triangle in two places or in no places, unless it basically overlaps directly on the vertex there. But if it does, you know, how many intersections will we actually end up finding, you know, with those segments on this triangle and on that one? You know, I mean, the math can get a little tricky there, you know, because of precision issues. Okay? Honestly, I would do that because it's a lot more robust, or a lot more easily robust. You know, the worst that can happen is you have edge artifacts. Okay? Of course, next, for extra credit, you have interpolating attributes. So, let's say you find that this point is within the triangle. And you have some attribute. I don't care what it's called, you know, it's just a value, right? And the value is 1 here, 2 here, and 3 here. Say. What should the value be here? That means, you know, that's interpolating. Okay? That's what gets you textures on the triangles correctly, by interpolating the texture coordinates, right? That's what gets you lighting, by interpolating the lighting values. So, how should you go about doing that interpolation? Anybody venture a guess?
Barycentric coordinates.
Barycentric coordinates is one of them. It's the most common. I've actually, you know, put a little bit about, basically mentioned the method in the website. I have not explained it. You know, you can find it in books. You can find it on the internet in various places. But one way to understand barycentric coordinates is, say, this edge here, okay? There is a barycentric coordinate, which is kind of like a distance from this point to this edge, okay? Any point within the triangle will have 3 barycentric coordinates. So one of them is the distance between this point and this edge, okay? But normalized, divided by the distance between this point and this edge. Such that it is 1 over here, and 0 on the edge. So any point along the edge will have a 0. This point will have a 1, and anything in between, you know, will have a ratio between the two. Okay. So that's 1 barycentric coordinate. Okay. This is the barycentric coordinate of this edge and this vertex here, which is the opposite vertex. You can get 3 of them. You have this edge and this vertex. And then you have this edge and this vertex. If you get the barycentric coordinate of this vertex and this edge over here, okay, you can use that as a weight. You have 3 coordinates and 3 values. So you just multiply these by that coordinate. Multiply the 1 by the coordinate that you get between this point and this edge. And you take this 3 here, this value on this vertex, and you multiply it by the barycentric coordinate you get between this vertex and this edge. And the result is a correct interpolation. Okay. there are other methods of rasterization and interpolation. You know, there's one method that's very typical and classic is to take any triangle, split it into along a horizontal, basically find the middle vertex, the one that's not the top one or the bottom one, split horizontally there, you have two triangles, start on this vertex and start scanning down like this. For, you know, using an algorithm like you would use to draw a line, you know, you basically find the ends of every scan line that lie within the triangle. And then what you do is you just interpolate between here and here, interpolate between here and here, and then the results that you get, you know, you interpolate between them horizontally like that. Those algorithms are the fastest ones that you can do on a CPU. You know, they can also be kind of tricky and finicky, but you might want to try them. Okay. The last thing, which we already don't have time for, is perspective correction. Now, maybe I should have put in here something that says, oh, turn off perspective correction, but you will see what I mean by perspective correction if you manage to implement interpolation. Okay, but you will see in the queue is that you'll see distortion along, you know, extra distortion, you know, that is most pronounced along the diagonal that splits the two triangles on the face. And you will see it. It basically, these straight lines over here will not be straight anymore. You know, they'll go here and then continue in a different direction. The reason is that things that are linear on the screen are not linear in the world. And the distance between these lines over here is kind of linear in the world. Okay. So if you do the naive interpolation, things do not become linear when you interpolate in screen space. So you have to correct. And in order to correct, you have to undo the perspective division, basically. So what you do is you interpolate the 1 over W, and you interpolate the attribute divided by W. So instead of interpolating the attributes, you first divide them on the vertices by W. And then you also interpolate the 1 over W by itself to find interpolated 1 over W's and then divide the two so that the W's cancel out again. And, you know, that basically corrects for that. Anyway, it's kind of already over the limit. So, if you have any questions, you can go ahead and stay and ask me. Otherwise, I will see you next week or maybe on Tuesday or maybe over the next